Improve your construction projects with real-time insights direct from the site with Procore's easy-to-use platform. Learn more at Procore.com. Procore, software for the people who build the world.
It's Wednesday, the 20th of September, 2023, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop from the Construction Index. And today we have a special guest joining us. It's Balfour Beatty's Group Sustainability Director, Joe Gilroy, which means that instead of the usual hot air, you'll be getting something altogether cooler and lighter, and we're talking about hydrogen. How do you like that introduction then, Jo?
Brilliant introduction. Thank you, David. And yes, no pressure. I must be cooler and lighter, understood.
Well, I say lighter only because hydrogen, of course, is a very light element.
Absolutely.
But as a topic, and we'll be devoting the entire discussion to this, as a topic, hydrogen is quite carries a lot of weight, very much in the news at the moment. In fact, Jo, the reason we invited you on, the main reason, in fact, was because you posted a comment on the Balfour Beatty website this week, or last week rather, talking about hydrogen and the results of a trial that you've been doing up at the Royal Botanic Gardens in Edinburgh, looking at various greener options to diesel engines. So I thought maybe we could start by talking about that. What have you found out about hydrogen up in Edinburgh?
Oh, well, yeah. So as you say, we've got a site. It's the Royal Botanic Gardens, and it's very much our experimental zone, you know, where we're testing out different technology. What works, what doesn't work, why does it work? And critically, you know, what are the pitfalls that we need to avoid? And, you know, when it comes to hydrogen, I think everyone is largely in agreement that there is tremendous potential with this technology, but there are some significant lessons that need to be learned, not just in terms of, well, where are we going to source it from? Because the hydrogen supply chain is still very embryonic, but also utilizing hydrogen as a fuel source requires us as a construction business and in particular our projects, we have to work in a very different way. Hydrogen is not the same as diesel. It's not a drop-in. It requires you to set up your site in a different way. You need, for example, significantly more space. You know, hydrogen as a fuel actually produces, you know, more energy per unit than diesel, but it's a gas, so it's inherently voluminous. Yes, you can compress it, but you do still require a degree of space. And as you say, you know, David, it is light and cool, but that does also mean that if you are utilizing it as a fuel source within an enclosed space, you know, God forbid you have a leak, it's lighter than air. It's going to, you know, drift up to the ceiling and it's going to sit there unless you have really effective ventilation. So it does require a rethink around how do you get it onto site? How do you position it on site so that it is safe? That is the primary consideration. And what are your, you know, redundancy processes, again, for making sure that, you know, you're using it effectively, but also in a way that ensures that we do maintain site safety.
Yeah. I mean, you created a bit of a stir last year.
Me? No, I don't create stirs, David.
It wasn't just you, but I mean, we reported, because everybody was talking about HVO, hydrotreated vegetable oil, as a replacement for diesel because it's renewable, it's organic, all the rest of it. And this came in the wake of the withdrawal of the red diesel rebate for construction users. And everybody sort of jumped on this sort of HVO bandwagon and said, you know, this is great stuff, it's green, and we're going to convert to this. And then you spoiled all that. Well, not just you, I admit. There are other people, it wasn't just you alone, other people did point out that actually HVO wasn't without its disadvantages, the fact that it was the finite resource and you couldn't really convert wholesale to HVO if you're going to rely on, you know, waste oil from chippies and that kind of thing. You know, when I say chippies, I mean chip shops. So that sort of rather put a damper on the HVO debate, that it wasn't this panacea. Do you see hydrogen as a more promising option? And whereas HVO, I think a lot of people now regard it as a transitionary option between diesel and something a little bit more or more long term. Do you see hydrogen as a long term option now, as a result of your trials?
I do see hydrogen as being part of what I'm going to call the sustainable solution mix. But, you know, you make a really critical point by you know, referring to HVO. We, as an industry, we are looking for a panacea that doesn't exist. And I think, you know, we need to be sort of, and this is, if you like, the next transition of businesses really embracing what sustainability means. There is no one-size-fits-all solution. There is no sustainable fuel out there that doesn't have a trade-off, a compromise, or a sustainable fuel that, you know, when you look at the complexity of a construction site and all of the different pieces of equipment that are run at any given time, there is no fuel, hydrogen included, that is going to do it all. So what we are actually working towards, and I think what we need to be more honest about and open about as an industry, is what fuels work in what circumstances and what are the trade-offs. And also, you know, looking at HVO, for example, I do think that HVO has a place, but one of the things that we do need to be really clear on is the transparency around how is it sourced, where does it come from, which country is producing it, what are the raw ingredients, and what is the true environmental benefit? Because one of the things that we are confusing in our race to net zero is, what are we aiming for here? Are we aiming for net zero, or are we actually aiming for sustainable development? Because I would argue it's the latter. You know, we want a sustainable economy, a sustainable society. Now, you can achieve net zero today by being inherently unsustainable, because it's not just about low carbon. If we've got low carbon solutions that are eroding biodiversity, for example, just as one example, or or compromising fresh water sources, or having an impact on all of the social elements, you know, again, promoting a low carbon technology that maybe is embroiled in or has the risk of modern slavery, you're not being sustainable, and actually you're creating a problem elsewhere. So
I think a lot of people would, people would be a bit disappointed to hear you say that net zero and sustainability aren't necessarily compatible.
Oh no, it's not that they're not compatible, because net zero is part of sustainable development. But what we need to be aware of is that we can achieve net zero today without being sustainable, by going for a panacea, a one-size-fits-all solution, without being open and transparent around what are the actual environmental and social benefits, and what are the actual environmental social trade-offs.
Well, I think we've learned about that recently with the London administration's expansion of the ULEZ zone, which of course has really put a cat amongst the pigeons, particularly with small trades in and around London. I think that's highlighted the fact that sustainability and net zero aren't necessarily interchangeable when it comes to, you know, when you're talking about the 2050 deadline.
Can I ask, Dave? Hello, Joe.
Hi, Phil.
David's introduced the topic of HVO much quicker than I thought he would. I thought we were going to have a much longer conversation about hydrogen.
I didn't.
Well,
I thought you guys get straight to it.
I'd like to, in a minute, go back to Edinburgh and get more detail of everything that's going on there, because that sounds super interesting. But since we're on the topic of HVO prematurely, and I noticed on your post on the Balfour Beatty website, you have a hierarchy of fuel hierarchy principles, and you've got HVO right at the bottom, high carbon intensity, even below fossil fuels. I find it fascinating that you've put your head above the parapet on this last year, and you were the person that called it out, frankly, and other people said, oh, well, if Balfour Beatty is saying it, it's okay to say it, it must be right. And I think it's you know, the role you've taken in this, it's shown more leadership than, frankly, the Construction Leadership Council has shown on the whole issue of fuel and what we're doing in the construction industry. But with HVO, is your concern about it, do you mistrust the certifications, the certificates of sustainability, and that say this is all come from waste and not from new deforestation and palm oil and so on? Are you concerned about the certification process, or is it simply that, okay, some HVO that's knocking around at the moment is genuinely a waste product, genuinely fine, but that in itself is not a sustainable resource, because we will rapidly run out of waste product and we'll have to start chopping down trees if we go down that route.
Fundamentally, yes, because so there's a couple of key points that you've highlighted there that I'll address in turn. So firstly, there isn't enough volume of HVO to meet what would be the overall demand just from the construction sector. And remember, we're not the only sector looking at it. You know, you've got distribution, retail, etc., you know, and we're one of many. The HVO that is currently in existence is fully utilized by existing industries. And we're now another player that's coming in saying, hey, we want our slice of this pie. And we need to, again, just be honest with ourselves for a moment and say, humanity doesn't have a really good track record of not doing something environmentally and inherently environmentally damaging and inherently unsustainable in order to fulfill the needs of a growing demand. And if you've got a whole sector, construction, waiting and saying we want HVO, there's a lot of money to be made there. Now, does that mean that developing nations or countries that already are significantly invested in the raw material, palm oil, does this mean that they're all of a sudden that they're not going to take a bite of that cherry, that they're not going to be causing deforestation in order to grow the raw material to meet a growing demand? Probably not. No, we don't have a good track record of saying, hey, this isn't the right thing to do. In terms of certification systems, you know, certification of a sustainable product is critically important. And it's not about distrusting the certifiers in question. But again, we have a history of certification schemes that then when people did a bit of a deep dive, they were found to be wanting. It was like, well, actually, this isn't the whole picture. And that's the key with HVO. We don't have the whole picture. And when you look at the research, the individuals and the companies that are really pro it, you sort of look at what they're invested in, you think, well, you would be pro it. And then on the other side as well, you look at the individuals that are really anti it, and you say, well, you would be, because look at what you're invested in. We don't have an independent voice on HVO in terms of its the security around where it's coming from. Is this really a sustainable solution? And that's why, ourselves, along with a number of our other industry partners, have worked and we're partnering with the Sustainability Supply Chain School to do a real independent deep dive, you know, unbiased around HVO. Is it a sustainable solution? And if so, in what circumstances? Hmm. When we came out and, you know, we were, you know, it was very kind of you to say, you know, Balfour Beatty did stand up and we did take a leadership position in HVO. We were later actually supported by the Environment Agency that came out with the same position. You know, we weren't standing up and saying, this is a blanket no to HVO. We were standing up and saying, hold on, everybody. There is no such thing as a sustainable panacea. What we need to do here is the due diligence over the supply chain, because for any organization, if we're just going to focus on net zero, any organization, 80 to 90% of our carbon emissions are in our supply chain. So if you're only focusing on the carbon that's emitted at the point that you burn the fuel, you know, you're focusing on a tiny little segment of your carbon footprint, and you've potentially achieved a minuscule saving at the expense of a monumental increase buried, hidden in your supply chain. And that's what we have to avoid.
Not simple, is it?
let's go back to the beginning again, if we may.
Of course.
Edinburgh Botanical Gardens. Why that site? What machinery have you got on site, and what machinery is being fueled by what fuel?
So why that site? A couple of reasons. Firstly, you know, the Scottish government, you know, credit to them. They're really proactive in this space. And also they've got, a number of innovation funds, such as their hydrogen innovation scheme that they use to help companies, you know, provide some seed funding for these ideas. Because a lot of this technology, because it is so new and so innovative, it's not cheap. So we've got a really willing partner in the Scottish government, and also we've got a really willing customer. You know, the Royal Botanic Gardens, they were willing to say, look, you know, this is a pretty typical construction site. It's an environmental scheme. You know, the gardens themselves are critically important for biodiversity purposes. But this is a typical construction site in the sense of it contains the challenges that we would often find. Restrictions around space. You know, we've got existing infrastructure that we're trying to preserve. So, we had that willingness from, both the government and the client.
What's the project? Sorry, Jo, is it a refurb project or is it a new build as well?
Yes, it's a bit of both. So we're refurbishing the beautiful architectural structure of the botanical
the greenhouses, are they basically?
Yes, I'm trying to think of a better word for greenhouse because the greenhouse doesn't really do it credit. I mean, it's the most stunning structure, but yes, it is.
We ran a feature on this actually, I think earlier this year. I'm just trying to find which issue it was so I can remind listeners.
It's a glorious, glorious greenhouse, and it's a beautiful cast iron structure that's been painted over. So we're stripping the paint off and looking at that cast iron structure, and then there is a new build element attached to it as well. And then in terms of the machinery on site, we've got a little bit of everything. So we've got some of the heavier equipment from dump trucks and excavators, we've got handheld tools for our staff on site, we've got our temporary cabins, generators. So again, in that sense, it's a real bread and butter site that allows us to experiment with those different pieces of equipment, whether you're talking about staff welfare cabins, plant equipment, or handheld tools.
There's a lot of stuff already out there which it's reasonably mainstream now in terms of solar powered lighting towers and cabins, and even I don't know whether solar powered generators work particularly well or not, or if they've got enough juice to them. But what have you got that's perhaps more cutting edge that other people might not have?
Oh my goodness. Cutting edge, it would be around the hydrogen technology. We have some fantastic strategic suppliers that we are working with, all of whom are invested in really unpacking the capability of hydrogen. Whether you're talking about deploying hydrogen fuel through a retrofitted combustible engine, so you're doing it through a traditional combustion engine design, or whether you're doing it through fuel cell technology. So again, experimenting with both of those options and looking at what are the benefits whilst also what are the considerations. So if you take, so for example, the hydrogen fuel cell technology, you effectively get more energy out of that delivery vehicle for the hydrogen. But you do have to take into consideration things like dust, for example. They're very dust sensitive, moisture sensitive, etc. Whereas the traditional combustion engine, that's a much quicker route to market for this new technology. But the hydrogen that is utilized through a traditional combustion engine isn't as efficient. So you have that efficiency loss. So it's tinkering to find out for which piece of plant equipment is the best solution. And I think that's what we, as an industry, need to realize, that we're actually moving away from a very simple, unsustainable situation, which is you've got your diesel, we know the fuel, we know how to store it, we know how to refill, we know how to move it around our sites. And we're moving away from that simplicity to a very complicated fuel delivery model for sustainable projects, which is where projects based on what they're, the nature of the works and their location are going to be drawing on multiple different sources of sustainable fuel, whether you're talking about renewable energy from the grid, whether you're talking about having some pieces of your plant equipment that can be electrified efficiently and effectively. Others might be running off hydrogen, and then you'll have others that will be using a drop-in biodiesel or and then you might have some that actually, due to the nature of the piece of equipment and the technology lag, that are still running off traditional diesel. It's going to be a really complicated mix going forward.
And it's not just one type of hydrogen. We talk about blue hydrogen and green hydrogen, and they're not the same thing. And there's a very fundamental difference. Explain what the difference is between blue and green hydrogen.
Well, yes, you've got blue, green, but don't forget pink, brown, black, and grey. So
what?
Oh yes, really? Yes, absolutely. So this is I go back to, open, transparent conversations are so important, because people can say, "Hey, I'm using hydrogen." You think, "Yes, it's great," and then you realise it's black hydrogen that's a byproduct from one of the coal refinement processes. So, black and brown is hydrogen that is a byproduct from coal, essentially. Right. Pink is from nuclear. Grey is from, I believe, the production of methane. But blue is from the production of natural gas. It's a byproduct. But one of the reasons that makes it blue is because traditionally in extracting the hydrogen, we do release CO2. And there is a conversation around whether blue hydrogen is viable, because what we would be doing is capturing the CO2 and locking it away. But there are some initial studies that suggest that blue hydrogen, you know, for all of its, you know, environmental benefits, it's also quite energy intensive to extract the hydrogen and lock the CO2 away. Whereas green hydrogen is produces no carbon. So it's just hydrogen produced electrolysis. So you're running a current through water. The current is obviously produced from renewable energy sources, solar, wind, etc. So the, you know, the green hydrogen supply chain is extremely embryonic. You know, we are a few years away from this being not only viable in terms of having a regular supply, but viable in terms of cost. So I think this is why, you know, that there is a very established supply chain that are looking at all of this. And this is why they're thinking, well, a bit like your point around HVO, it being a stepping stone. Mm-hmm. What is the hydrogen stepping stone as we begin to develop green hydrogen capability? But but what is going to be so important, you know, to avoid hydrogen falling into the same trap as HVO, as we start to use it and as we start to experiment with it and see what works, we have to be crystal clear what source of hydrogen, because they're not all the same. And if we go back to our Scotland site, you know, alongside, you know, having our innovation zone with the Royal Botanic Gardens, we've also had some match funding provided from the Scottish Government in order to retrofit some of our existing vehicles, a couple of gritters and some of our other road vehicles, mm-hmm. with a hydrogen fuel that will be a mix. So it will be mixed with diesel to see if we can actually run critical pieces of road infrastructure in a sustainable way on the M77. But again, that hydrogen source is green. So, you know, there's no point in experimenting with this unless you're using a truly sustainable source of hydrogen.
When we're talking about transitionary sort of solutions, presumably we have to develop the technology to use hydrogen. Otherwise, there's no point in finding green ways of producing it. But presumably, you could have a hydrogen-powered piece of equipment that's running off dirty old black hydrogen and not really contributing much towards sustainability. But presumably, that again is a stepping stone, because when you've managed to eradicate the need for that less sustainable hydrogen source, you can just switch to using green hydrogen, because it's basically the same material, it's the same gas, isn't it?
It could be considered as a stepping stone. I think the argument against that would be, you know, do we really have the time? You know, when we look at the climate emergency, do we really have the time for our stepping stones to be so tiny? You know, I mean, I would suggest that the difference between moving from, you know, diesel onto a black or brown hydrogen source is that a big enough step in the right direction, given the scale of the climate emergency? I think that would be the counter to that being considered a viable stepping stone. I think sort of utilizing hydrogen that comes from better sources than coal should be the stepping stones that we are putting most of our effort into.
Right. But hydrogen is hydrogen, isn't it? I mean, it's the same gas, whether it's produced as a byproduct of the coal industry or green hydrogen. So what I'm trying to get to is, you know, are we sort of getting ahead of ourselves in terms of developing ways of consuming hydrogen before we actually have a sustainable source of hydrogen, of clean hydrogen?
But you have to create demand for it before anyone will produce it.
Yes.
This all comes from, you know, where we build the demand, the supply will follow, because, you know, the supply chain is going to follow the market signal, aren't they? And that's what, you know, Balfour Beatty is about. You know, we're working with a number of our, you know, high profile clients in order to send a really strong signal to our supply chain to say, look, there is demand for this. It is coming. It needs to be in the right way. We need to not make the mistakes of the past. Again, I go back to that open and transparent supply chain piece. But yes, you know, Phil, you're absolutely right. It's about sending the right signal as to what stepping stone we want and why. And whilst we're waiting for that supply chain, you know, maturity to catch up, we do need to be looking at how this technology can be practically implemented on a construction site, because you know, you've really got to do this from the point of design. You know, you've got to set up your sites and design your projects in a way to run off an alternative fuel. You know, construction has existed for a very long time running off a single fuel source, and it's very good at it. And what we're saying now is you've got to change, and it's not a small change, it's a big change. And in that change, you have to consider, you know, and again, you know, I think this is something that we can't emphasize enough, really. You know, we've Balfour Beatty holds the standard on keeping our staff safe on site. And, you know, you cannot introduce something that, whilst it may be sustainable and low carbon, is going to fundamentally compromise the safety of your people on site. So you've got to look at the solution in its totality. All of those benefits, all of those considerations.
But there is a lot of momentum, isn't there? So there's a lot of momentum building towards the conversion to hydrogen. I mean, it's not just Balfour. I mean, Balfour Beatty is clearly at the vanguard, but other tier one contractors, BAM and Skanska amongst them, are also doing a lot here. And the government, you ran a story recently, Phil, I can't remember exactly what it was, last week, I think, about a BAM-led initiative to develop the use of hydrogen as an alternative to diesel. That was...
the whole bunch. The government, the UK government gave out to England and Wales, separate from the Scottish initiatives that Jay's been talking about, a whole bunch of grants under one of their schemes for R&D projects. And there's a bunch of these things.
Yeah. And it's, you know, this government-led funding is absolutely critical, because, you know, this technology, as we said, it's, you know, it isn't cheap. It's expensive, and we have to find ways to co-fund this. But the you know, the government-led funding is absolutely critical.
Whoa, Joe, just a minute. This is where I have to. This is the one thing I wanted to challenge you on in your piece.
Oh dear, here we go.
You talk about the need for you know, my money, taxpayer money, to fund Balfour Beatty. You look at the £2 billion profits that the top 100 construction companies made last year, and probably the top five house builders made at least that profit. The construction industry is always saying we want government money. Why not? And I understand that Balfour Beatty shouldn't have to pay for it all. You're taking the lead and doing this stuff for the good of the, not just the industry, probably not even just for the economy. I mean, conceivably, it wouldn't be a stretch to say it's for the good of mankind, saving the planet and all of that. So Balfour Beatty shouldn't have to pay for it. But if the construction industry is wanting a clean fuel, why not a CITB kind of tax across the industry, and say that that's what will go towards the developing the market, or developing the technology for clean fuels in construction? Why should the taxpayer have to pay for it? Shouldn't the taxpayer money be going to teachers and nurses rather than big construction companies?
What a question. First of all, taxpayers' money should absolutely be prioritised for our critical services, particularly around the NHS and teachers, and not just that as well. Let's not forget our fire service and our policemen, 100%. But, you know, the role of government as well is to support the development of a sustainable society, which is multifaceted. And I don't think that they're not just giving taxpayer money to construction businesses. You know, they are quite rightly putting money aside for innovation funds for a whole host of different industry players, not just the big players, but also, social enterprises, SMEs, you know, the real innovators, the new entrepreneurs that just emerging with these future technologies, in order to access that funding, that in order to, you know, seed fund their ideas, and they don't have the resources, as you quite rightly say, that a big construction company does. For us, I mean, we certainly don't just take a handout from government. You know, we have significantly invested in this technology in our own right, and where we've got a willing partner, such as the Scottish Government, that is willing to offer seed funding, some match funding, in order to support the development of this technology, that is only for the greater good. You know, the more organisations that step in and collaborate to support the development of this technology, the faster we can go. Yes, Balfour Beatty will continue to put its hand in its pocket and invest in this technology, but we don't have unlimited funds. We can only go as fast as our resources allow us to. The more people that step in and join and say, we're going to actually put some skin in this game to go faster, that's only for the greater good. That's only going to benefit everybody, including the British taxpayer.
well defended.
Shut you up,
well
Phil.
Defended.
I was expecting a good. Hey, it's a good question. It's a very good question.
It's just that the all too often when you hear people say, you know, we have a problem, the government has to fix it. I mean, it's like you know, I feel sorry for the poor old education secretary. All the schools which are under local authority control are crumbling, and suddenly it's her fault. I have some sympathy for her.
Well, do you know, I started off life as a secondary school English teacher, so I have got immense sympathy for the educational sector, and yeah, we need to do a lot more there. But, you know, why are we looking at hydrogen? It's because we're ultimately trying to achieve that net zero goal, aren't we? But we have... As a sector, we've defined it as a race, you know, and we use that language a lot, don't we? Let's race to net zero. Mm-hmm. And I totally understand why we talked about it as a race, because it was to denote a sense of speed. You know, we have to go as quickly as possible. And that's correct. But this race concept has slightly tipped into this idea of, well, we have to beat each other there. And it's like, no, no, because if any one of us crosses this finish line, we all lose. So I go back to the more that we can co-invest together, because, you know, change is not, it's not straightforward and it's not cheap. The more we can co-invest together, the faster we are ultimately going to go. And I think government has a role to play in that. But I, you know, my personal opinion is that industry, not just construction, but other industries will lead the way in really investing in a sustainable future.
Mm. I have one more political question, which is a difficult one for you to...
Oh, dear.
You may or may not have a view on this. I don't know. But it seems to me that from a, you know, geopolitical standpoint, the British Empire was built on coal and steam, and the Industrial Revolution driven by coal. Mm. And then after that, the British Empire faded, and the power of the Middle East and the USA was on petroleum, oil coming out of the ground, new geopowers and new money shifted around the world. If hydrogen becomes the new petroleum, what's the new world order going to look like? Who's going to be the hydrogen kings of the world?
The hydrogen barons, yeah.
Phil, you seem to think I'm a psychic. I'm just going to pull out my magic eight ball. Hold on, I've got to.
You seem to have a pretty... You seem to be one of the smarter people on this topic that we've spoken to. So I think you have a certain visionary sense, I think.
Oh, well, you know, this is... I mean... This is why my sort of drumbeat within Balfour Beatty is I keep saying that, you know, sustainability is not actually an environmentalist movement. It's a business movement. And it's a business movement because the people that, or the industries, the sectors, the companies that grab hold of this agenda, you know, there it's not just a leadership position. You know, you're there, as you say, you know, the owner of the forerunner in the new technology, the new innovation, the new thing that everybody's going to want and have a demand for. But I mean, in terms of, you know, country, I think...
from my position of ignorance, could it be the great leveller? Because if hydrogen is basically fairly simple to produce, I think, if not cheap, I don't know.
It is, yeah.
Could it not just be done on site? Could you not have a little micro hydrogen still sitting in the corner of your plant producing hydrogen for your site? Is that technically feasible? If not, why not?
There's no reason to say why it can't be the great leveller. And it's really nice to think that one day it will be the great leveller. I think in the short term, what we will see is we will see the countries with the greatest capacity to pivot and change very, very quickly. You know, countries that have, you know, the greatest cash resources to invest in this, you know, will probably be the leaders initially. And I think it will probably start with the countries that are the most at risk from the changing climate, you know, the countries that are experiencing the biggest shocks to their system, because they are going to need the change a lot quicker than those of us that aren't experiencing the worst of climate change yet. And I know you know, I know China gets, you know, they get a real hard rap for, you know, not being as engaged in the net zero and the sustainable journey as other nations. But it would not surprise me at all if it was a country like China that actually stole the thunder on a new fuel like hydrogen, because they have, you know, the land footprint, the cash resources, and the ability to pivot and move very, very quickly. You know, we saw them do that with the production of solar panels. We saw them do that with the production of wind turbines. Yes, I mean, when they make up their mind to do something, it's like, phew, you know, they're there, and they do it. So it's really nice to think that it will one day be the great leveler, Phil, because you're right. It's not, you know, it's not overly difficult to produce. As different ways to produce it, but it must be produced in a responsible way. And, you know, and we mustn't forget as well, you know, hydrogen is in itself a greenhouse gas. So what you don't want is lots of production facilities that are unregulated, that are unchecked, where you have the risk of hydrogen leaks, because again, that's hydrogen is more potent as a greenhouse gas than carbon. So that has to be avoided at all costs.
Oh, that'll surprise a lot of people. I didn't know that.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, people think about climate, people think about carbon as the only climate change causing gas. But actually, the climate change gases, it's a whole family, and people first go to carbon, then they go to methane, but there's lots of other gases.
I think water vapour is the biggest contributor to global warming, isn't it?
Exactly. You know, there's all these other gases that actually, and it's the same with any natural element, really. Used in the right way, it's extremely beneficial and productive. Used in the wrong way, it's not. And it comes down to this responsibility piece and this sense of balance, you know. And it's the balance piece that we're very good as a species of disrupting to our detriment. So
going back to Phil's question about who will be the big, you know, the big supplier of hydrogen, you know, the hydrogen king, presumably it's people who have a lot of renewable energy, because of course that's how you produce the green hydrogen. Is hydrogen produced from nuclear energy also green hydrogen?
No, it's pink.
Qualify as green?
You were listening, David.
Pink.
I remember
that's
that.
Pink.
Okay, sorry. Yes, you did say that. Yeah,
yes,
I'm just a bit colorblind.
The grading on that is, I believe they do call that pink hydrogen. And
but isn't it sustainable and well, green? I mean, because after all, nuclear power was the big ogre, wasn't it, back in the 70s and 80s, when Atomkraft Neindanke was on every sort of German notice board. But it doesn't warm the planet, does it, nuclear power? Not the way that fossil fuels do. So surely wouldn't that be a sustainable way of producing hydrogen?
Do you know, I read an absolutely fascinating opinion piece not that long ago, and it said, can you be an environmentalist today without being pro-nuclear? And it was a really challenging piece because its fundamental argument was, you know, we're not trying to shift to a sustainable economy with a small global human population. You know, we've got a huge population, it's ever growing, and is there truly a energy source that's going to meet those energy demands that doesn't include nuclear as part of the transition? Mm. It was a brilliant piece. And I think, you know, for me, my personal opinion, and it is only my personal opinion, is that, you know, nuclear is part of the mix to getting to a low carbon economy. But the technology in itself, for me, what makes the technology so important is that it is the stepping stone to nuclear fusion. Mm. And that's got to be the end goal.
This conversation's taken a quite sort of highbrow, wide turn. Can I bring it back to diggers and dump trucks and nuts and bolts? You've tested, you've been running trials with hydrogen fuel-celled powered machinery and hydrogen-powered. I don't know, is that liquid hydrogen you put in the tank, or are you putting gas in like a helium balloon?
It's gas, compressed gas.
Right. Hmm. Can you fill it with, can you use liquid hydrogen like LNG?
I'm not 100% familiar with liquid hydrogen as of yet. I've been sort of focusing on the gas side of things.
You're using compressed gas, right?
Yes.
So
yeah.
If Balfour Beatty next year is going to buy, you know, whatever, a new 20-ton excavator, would it prefer to have that fueled, have a fuel cell, or with hydrogen, compressed hydrogen gas powering it? What do you lean to at the moment?
So I think our engineering community is slightly split on which is the best one. I'm hope that I'm going to give the right answer here, because I've got a very important member of my team that will be very cross with me if I give the wrong one. But my understanding is that we are more inclined to the hydrogen fuel cell technology because it is more, you know, more efficient in delivering the hydrogen. You were actually able to get that energy, maximum energy from the fuel.
Does that change if you go up to a bigger machine though? Or if you went up to a 100 ton mining excavator, would that change? Or is that basically you lean towards fuel cells over compressed hydrogen gas?
At the moment, we lean towards fuel cells. We need to do more experimentation with those bigger pieces of equipment to understand, well, actually, what is the best, you know, solution for that piece. And I go back to, you know, in with what we're doing with this Scotland's Hydrogen Innovation Fund. You know, we're trialling a different hydrogen solution whereby we're using it again as a mix alongside a traditional diesel within the same combustible engine. So again, that's looking at, well, is there a way to introduce hydrogen to lower the carbon footprint of a traditional piece of equipment? In this case, it's a road gritter, but for a piece of equipment that, you know, in the depths of winter in Scotland cannot fail. So, you know, it's got to run. It's got to, you know, obviously spray the salt, keep the road safe. So is there a way that we can utilise it in a mixed capacity? So it totally depends really on the piece of plant equipment. And this is what we're doing at the Royal Botanic Gardens, is depending on what we're running, we are seeing what works and what doesn't work. And sort of very much working closely alongside our partners in this space, organisations like GeoPura, you know, critical partner for us. But, you know, also further into the supply chain, you've got organisations like JCB, Caterpillar, and they're really looking and spending a lot of, you know, to your point, Phil, not using the taxpayer cash. They're spending their own dime on, for, you know, for their pieces of plant equipment, what is the best solution? Do you bolt on a hydrogen fuel cell, or do you utilise, or do you redesign and retrofit a traditional combustible engine? And again, the verdict's out. You know, this is still the experimentation phase.
I'm showing my ignorance here. Would a fuel cell drive an internal combustion engine somehow, turn the crank? Or
no.
David, you come on, tell me.
David's probably more across it than I am.
Well, I don't know. I'm sure I'm not. But my understanding is, I'd always understood that fuel cells actually generate electricity. So your primary
is more like a battery,
electric motor.
Yes, it's like a battery. Yeah.
I mean, absolutely. I got the feeling. I was interested to hear you say what you just said, Joe, because I got the feeling that we are moving more towards the use of hydrogen as a fuel in an internal combustion engine. Because a lot of the news that's been sort of dribbling out over the last few months has been about that kind of thing.
That's the quicker route to market.
It is,
very clear.
Right.
That's the quicker route to market. But again, it's not a cheap route to market.
Right.
So I was chatting actually to one of our engineers this morning, and he was sort of giving me some of the statistics around, you know, the uplift in costs. Mm-hmm. And it is quite significant because, you know, you're fundamentally having to pump more hydrogen through that combustion engine to get the same amount of power.
Right,
and
yes.
Hydrogen's not cheap because, again, you've got that embryonic supply chain.
Yeah.
Where is it coming from? So, but it is absolutely the quickest route to market, and for certain pieces of plant equipment will be the right way to go.
Right.
It's certainly that the technology is in a much more ready phase than the fuel cells. But again, it goes back to, you know, what type of hydrogen you want to use as well.
You mentioned at the beginning of the conversation that hydrogen is a very voluminous fuel, you know, it occupies a lot of space.
Mm.
Presumably,
more so than diesel.
Yeah, more so than diesel. So, I mean, if you were running an excavator, say on hydrogen, then presumably you'd have to refuel it far more frequently than you would if it was diesel, or you'd have to have an absolutely massive fuel tank.
Yes, and that was the difficulty that we ran into at the Royal Botanic Gardens. It was, we just simply didn't have the amount of space that was required in order to house the amount of compressed hydrogen gas that was required to run some of these heavier pieces of equipment. And also, you know, depending on, you've also got to look at where you're storing it on site, because in that way it's no different from diesel, in the sense of, you know, God forbid there is an issue, a spill or something goes horribly wrong. Mm. You can't have it located next to, say, you know, your next storage unit for hydrogen gas or a piece of plant equipment that's got hydrogen gas in it, because otherwise you're going to end up with a serious explosion going on. So you've got to look at it from the amount of space needed for the hydrogen fuel itself, and then where you locate it, again, to ensure that you maintain a safe working environment. But this was, you know, this was very similar to, I think, what the industry experienced when we started to switch over to electric. Mm-hmm. You know, again, electric is part of the solution mix. But, you know, how do you run pieces of plant equipment that only run off a battery? Mm. How do you run them if you've got a construction site that's in the middle of nowhere that doesn't have access to a grid connection?
You need a great big diesel generator to charge your battery.
Well, you know, this is it. You know, I mean, you know, you most certainly do not want to be in a situation of, you know, you've gone and bought this very expensive, very shiny piece of electric crane, and mm-hmm. and then you're having to charge it off a diesel generator. Yeah. It's just madness. So this goes back to, you know, what we said at the beginning. You know, we need to, as an industry, there is no panacea. There isn't going to be just one fuel, one sustainable fuel that's used on these construction sites. You've got to start at the point of design. You've got to look at, what are you building? You know, what piece of equipment you've got to use to do the building, and therefore what is the most sustainable source of fuel that you can practically, feasibly, economically deploy on that site in order to power these pieces of equipment. And that's the bit we don't like to talk about, that as a industry of engineers, you know. Yeah. we like to go straight to the tech.
Sure.
You know, the piece of sexy equipment.
But there are all sorts of challenges out there.
I've got one final, probably stupid question. Does a tank full of hydrogen in any meaningful way reduce the weight and the ground bearing pressure of the machine? Because I know that when my car has got a tank full of petrol, it is less efficient than when the tank's nearly empty. The weight of a tank of petrol is enough to make the car less efficient. Does the opposite happen with hydrogen? If you fill your tank with hydrogen, your machine's lighter.
I mean, I would. The common sense part of me would say yes, because it's a gas. But I would defer that. I would defer a precise and 100% accurate answer to one of the sustainable engineers on my team, because they would be the best one to answer that. But logically, you would say yes.
But it's a bit like when you're on an aeroplane, you jump up in the air. You should end up somewhere different than where you jumped up, but you don't. Okay, it's not like that at all, but it's my lack of scientific brain.
Right. I don't suppose that a tank of hydrogen would make that much difference, Phil. I think that
these are pretty heavy pieces of
gear.
Yeah,
especially in a 30-ton excavator. I don't think it'd make much difference.
Not sure, but you know.
And if it's a small piece of kit, it wouldn't hold much hydrogen, so yeah.
Well, you know, small handheld pieces of kit, you know, really, we should be making them electric. But
sure. Well, they pretty much are. We talked about this, David and I, a couple of weeks ago. And not just electric, they're all going battery-powered rather than plug-in, which I don't think there's any particular eco-advantage over that. It's just convenience, I suppose. But
Yeah. It just shows you that there are no, as you said many times, Joe, there are no simple answers to this. It's horses for courses, and you've got to find the best solution. I remember during this conversation, I suddenly remembered an episode of Dad's Army many years ago, when they decided to convert Corporal Jones's butcher's van to run on town gas instead of petrol, because petrol was hard to find. So they had an enormous, great big bag of gas on the roof of his van, which of course was then punctured by their bayonets when they were doing bayonet practice. So that didn't work out.
Absolutely. Brilliant.
It just shows you, you know, you can't just retrofit necessarily. You've got to think it through.
Absolutely. And I think this is where, I mean, the really exciting thing is being, you know, working for an organization that has that supply chain and customer relationships to be able to set up a site, you know, like the Royal Botanic Gardens, whereby, you know, we can experiment, and that's what it's all about. And, you know, I really, you know, I think the net zero, towards a net zero site diaries that we're keeping, you know, if you read them, you know, we're really honest about what works and what doesn't work. And, you know, the one we did before is when we were looking at the, you know, what pieces of plant equipment we can run that are, you know, off battery technology, that are electrified. And, you know, and we were really honest about, well, it's got real limitations, particularly for big pieces of kit. You know, you've got to run, you know, 3 to 4 dumper trucks to do the job of one. And, mm-hmm. and one of the really interesting things that we found was that, you know, you can't hear an electric piece of plant equipment. So again, you know, if you've got individuals that are working on that site, it's how do you ensure that they're aware of the piece of equipment that's moving? Because normally, you know, and it's only when you're on those sites that you realize how much you rely on your hearing to identify potential risks and hazards. So, but it's really good fun. And I know that we've got a great team up there, and, you know, credit to them. You know, the project director, project managers, you know, they're really willing to have a go, knowing that it might not be a success, you know, knowing that actually we might identify some pitfalls, but it's only by identifying those. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, the success to net zero, it's not going to be a straight line. It's going to be all of these twists and turns and curves and, oh my God, that didn't work. And whoops, that was a disaster. And let's try again. And how do we fund this? And how do we secure that? And how do, you know, and that's part of the journey, part of the discovery.
In terms of this program, what's next? How long is that site at Edinburgh Botanical Gardens? How long is that to run for? Do you have another site lined up?
So we have so that site's got a little bit longer to go. I think it runs into halfway through next year, maybe a little bit longer than that. So we've got more opportunities to keep testing and trialing different hydrogen, in particular hydrogen options, but also alongside other pieces of new equipment, new technology. And yes, you know, we're lining up sites all the time. I mean, we've got again, we're sort of strategic partners for some major infrastructure works that are going on, Lower Thames Crossing being one, and all of these sites and all of these projects present opportunities to first of all take the learnings that we've got from Scotland and make sure that we implement them. That's the critical bit. You know, what works must be implemented. But then also, you know, when you're dealing with projects of a different nature and different scale, how we can then work with our clients and supply chain to test something else, to trial something else. So it's long pipeline of projects and opportunities to keep innovating.
Excellent. Right. Well, I'm glad you could manage to find half an hour for us this morning, Jo. I think we've kept you rather longer than you were meant to.
No, it's been a real pleasure chatting actually to you guys. And it's a really nice conversation. First time I've had the opportunity to take part in a podcast. So, and I'm just very glad, Phil, that you didn't ask what's the secret to life, the universe and everything.
Save that for next time.
I'm going to go away and I'll ask one of my engineers. I'll be like, guys, help.
Well, it'll be back to hot air again in a couple of weeks' time, Phil.
Carbon dioxide rather than hydrogen.
Carbon dioxide, exactly. Oh, well.
Jo, thank you very much indeed for joining us. This is my winding up, but from the another episode of Reconstruction from David and I and from Jo Gilroy from Balfour Beatty. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks a lot.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you both.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.